Welcome to the first episode of the Open Wound Research Podcast. My name is Willie Tinitinyiswa, CEO of Open Wound Research, and we are very excited in this inaugural episode to welcome Harm Smith as our first guest. Harm is a luminary in the world of European wound care, and it's just an honor to have him here on the podcast. Known Harm for a fair amount of time, and we've been belligerent together on calls, but welcome, Harm. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Zweli. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to have this talk, and to have perhaps some more people enjoy the wonderful discussions we always have.
No, I agree. I think, spending the next, let's call it now, just talking about some of the things we talked about and sharing that with the wider community, I think will be fun. So just to go through your bio a little bit before we get started, you were born in Amersfoort in the Netherlands, where I believe you still live.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I was born here and made a dashing step to go to Utrecht, which is 20 kilometers away, and then hurried back to Amersfoort. So globally in 20 kilometers or something like that. So yes, I'm happily here in Amersfoort.
Yeah. That's great. I hear it's a beautiful part of the Netherlands.
Yes, it's right in the center, and it's a medieval city, so we're having some fun here.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And you received your advanced degree from the University of Utrecht in biology?
I finished my studies as a molecular biologist, doing all kinds of funny DNA work on yeasts. So that's my background. Yeah,
that's great. And then currently, I believe you're the CEO of Biomedser as well.
Yeah, that's my current business vehicle, which I use as a central hub for all kinds of activities.
Yeah. Oh, great. And some other things you do as well is that you're a lecturer at wound care at Erasmus University, and I believe you sit on a couple of editorial boards.
Yes, correct. Yes, I used to be in commercial parts of wound care, and at some point I decided to stop there, and because I had some remarks which did not go well with the wound care community, so I decided to start teaching. So that's how I got into teaching wound care. And if you start teaching, you have to be very critical on what you teach. So that critical stance brought me also into some international editorial boards, like the Journal of Wound Care and recently the International Wound Journal. Yeah. So that's fun because then you can, you have to flex your mind for a bigger audience. So that's more challenging. So and I like that.
No, what I've always appreciated about you is the so-called flexing of the mind. And I think as we go through the podcast and talk about some of the things you've done, I think a lot of people will appreciate the kind of thought that you put into wound care, especially as a biologist. I think I find that incredibly interesting because most of my discussions are with clinicians and in our calls with each other, our talks, it's really interesting to see how a biologist thinks about wound care.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And it's different, I can tell you that, because I'm always wondering, like, what do I see and why do I see what I see? So what's going on in this patient or in this wound? And then I have to, as a biologist, you also learn to be humble. So you have to know your weakness and then stumble around in wound care, figuring out what's going on. And that's a different stance from medical doctors who are supposed to find solutions immediately. So they don't have the practical time or the training to ponder about funny things like what happened, what's the evolutionary cause of this thing happening here? Why is calcium playing a role in wound care? What is it? So those are the things a biologist can do where a medical professional usually doesn't have the time for. So that's biology, yes. Having fun on that, I can tell you that.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot of your stuff and some of the stuff you've shared with me. Maybe a good place to start is, and I always like to ask this question is, what is your origin story in science? I mean, what brought you to science as a young person, and what made you want to specialize in biology later on in life?
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but for me, there was never a question of being anything else but a biologist. So my grandfather was a cactus enthusiast. My dad was a forester. So there was no other option for me than to become a biologist. That's where my heart lies and that's my nature is.
A cactus. So let's take a little sidestep here. I did not know that. So a cactus biologist? What is that?
Well, he was not a cactus biologist. He was he was really into he liked cactuses very much. So he ended up with a glasshouse with the largest cactus collection of Europe for some reason. So as a child, I was roaming around in the cactuses, and I was also very interested in all the animals inside the glasshouse.
And your father too was.
Well, originally he's doing. It's called. I don't know the English translation for that, but if you have a large piece of land, you need someone to run it for you. So he was running castles and also large pieces of wood. And one of his hobbies was to have a profitable piece of land. So he was specialized in forests, making them bring profit for the owners of the land. People are complaining in the Netherlands about a certain type of pine tree we have here. And I said, yes, sorry, that was my dad's hobby. I think he planted half of the Netherlands with the tree. Yes.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. It's always interesting to learn where people come from science.
Yes.
You know, myself, my family didn't really have a scientific background, but I always was interested in things and found people around whom I could talk about these subjects. But so it's really fascinating to see someone born into science and kind of that's the pathway you're going to have.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think we share a curious mind. So that brings fun. Yeah.
No, definitely. So the origin story in science is actually pretty straightforward. I thought it would be much more circuitous. But what about your origin story in wound care? So you graduate with your advanced degree in biology. And how do you find yourself in wound care?
Oh, that's also, it's extremely boring. When I graduated, my first job was to be the temporary general manager of the Dutch Institute of Biology. So that was 30 years ago, and actually I'm still the treasurer of that one. So I'm still involved in biology, but then on a national scale and on an international scale, about policy parts. But then that wasn't, biology is not a place where you can make a lot of money. So then I went into pharmacy, pharmaceuticals, and then at some point I run into a headhunter and said, well, we have this company in Amersfoort, once again, because I was living in Amersfoort. You might want to go and have a look there. And that company was Coloplast. And then I ran into the company, I ran into it, and then we just had a good vibe and I liked it. I said, well, let's do it. So that was 1996. That was my first connection to wound care. So it's also accidentally, because a headhunter thought, this company is in Amersfoort, he's in Amersfoort, he will like it. So that's where the match comes from. So it's very, very boring start of wound care. Yeah. It started on day two when I was wondering, we have these wonderful dressings we sell. Well, I'm going to sell these wonderful dressings. So why do we sell them? What's the benefit they bring for our patients? So I asked the first time I asked the question, that's 2 days, I think, after I started working. So where is the evidence? And that question kept me busy until today. Because as it turned out, there was not too much evidence, not only for this company, but for nobody had evidence. That was really interesting. So that I think that sealed my fate as a biologist in wound care, because I knew I had a nice, big, hairy problem to put my teeth in and have fun with. So that's what brought me here today.
That's a really interesting take. So as a scientist, as a biologist, when you entered, you know, and you were doing the business of wound care, I mean, you've already alluded to it. There's evidence, problems with kind of rationale at times. As you continue your career, how did you kind of, as a scientist, deal with these business problems where you had to communicate to people or sell a product or create a product?
Well, the thing I always said is, because I quickly noticed that there might not be much evidence, but that people were very successful in healing patients. So the first thing I did was hiring not exactly commercial sales reps, but proper wound care nurses who could guide us and help us heal patients. So that's how it started. And the next step was to think about it, because you don't make friends if you are tossing, in Dutch we call it, throwing bats in chicken houses. or upsetting the public, that doesn't bring you much, because you also want to do good and help people. So that's how we started in devising stuff and figuring out and showing. And one of the things I always said is we have to be very kind and very gentle to our customers and help them in their job, because you have to realize that if you have a job which is not really well underpinned by a basic understanding, basic function of what wound care is, you're in a tough place, you're in a tough spot. So you have to help these people to heal these patients. So that is the most important part of it. So, and then in the end, of course, because wound care is was a peculiar part of the medical supply community. So in the end, I thought, well, now it's time to leave Coloplast. And I decided to go back into biotechnology, which molecular biology and biotechnology is sort of goes together very well. And then within 2 weeks, I was sitting at an investment company guy, and I said, well, you're getting out of wound care, is that? Yes. I said, well, we just invested in an American company in wound care, and they need your help. So I was exactly 2 weeks out of wound care, and then went straight back in. So that was the start of the BioMedServe as a consulting company. So that was really funny, because the product, I already knew the product, and I had tried to call Plus to pick it up, which I didn't. But I really liked the product. That was the real start of the next part of my journey. That was as in the commercial selling products. So then I devised a negative wound care machine, the first one after KCI in the Netherlands. But that was really funny to do. And I had also learned something, because everybody thinks it should be pricing or costing of wound care is very important. So I devised this thing with it was really inexpensive to make, and we used standard equipment in the hospitals. So that would bring down costs dramatically for the users. But sadly, our customer base didn't like that. They preferred the shiny beads of the competition, and they used that. So I did that for, I think, about 10 years, and then decided to leave that as well. And then I started doing with another friend of mine who had a company. Then I had a basket of products, and these products were would enable you to turn the buttons in the wound, because as a biologist, I always wondering what's going on, and are there any buttons I can push on or turn or influence what's going on in the wound. That's the real business, of course. And I started talking to these nurses, and these nurses thought within 5 minutes, "Ooh, how do I get rid of this man? Because I don't know what he's talking about, but it's definitely not my job, because I'm in wound care, and what he's talking about is not wound care." So that's the moment I decided to stop the commercial part and flipped over to starting to educate these people. So of course, if you don't get it, you need to know more about that. So that's the start of my educational path.
It's an interesting thing, because it's funny. I hear a lot of stories in wound care where people leave and they're immediately back within two. Yeah, because it's a small world, and I think when you reach a certain level of expertise, that expertise is always in demand, right? Whether it's especially in international markets. So it's really interesting to hear that you tried to escape wound care and they dragged you right back in very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, so that's actually a common refrain that I see. You know, and it's interesting because you pointed a couple of things. Wound care isn't a singular thing, right? It's educating, it's science, it's understanding the economics. And I think when people see value being delivered by a person, it's really hard to escape. It's like the Godfather; they keep dragging you back in.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Definitely is, yes.
So how I came across you the first time was, and we didn't speak until years later, but I was reading journals, and I read the Wounds UK journal in 2017, and there was an article talking about whether the EPUAP should adopt the NPUAP, or it's called now the NPIP, Krishna Alsat guidelines.
Yes.
And there were four people, and three of them were saying, it's okay, or, you know, it's fine. And then there was this one Dutchman.
Yes. I have a vivid remembrance of that, yes.
We just kept, it was funny to me because you just kept banging away at some of the issues around how, you know, there's sometimes a conflict between the science and the legal and the business. And how you're the scientist or about the science. So just walk me through some of your commentary around that, because I found it very interesting. I found it that you challenged some of the orthodoxy that was coming out of the NPIP at that time.
Yes. No, pressure injuries is the point where I always get rather rude, so some people might have to stop listening now. One of my general remarks here is about the national guideline for pressure injuries. I always ask, is it already finished, or do we still have time to toss it in the bin? That is my general approach. And the reason for that is, and that was also in this article, they start talking about pressure injury or pressure ulcers or whatsoever. And then I always wonder, so what are you talking about? Because you're talking about categories of the categories of damage, but that doesn't bring anything, because the only thing it tells me is that, okay, we have a category 4 ulcer. We now know that the amount of tissue, the amount of air where it used to be tissue is larger than if you had the category 1, but it doesn't tell you anything about its cause or what you have to do to resolve it. So that's an empty category. So that's the first one. So I said, well, can't we discuss about the difference in patients who are suffering from it? And then we have all the brain and scales and all these scales. But I kept wondering, and recently, you know me, Sredi, that I always, every week I have a new metaphor to use. So this week's metaphor is about your body temperature is supposed to be between 36.2 and 37.1 degrees. And we're very good at maintaining our body temperature at that. So what we do then, and that's the interesting part, we go to Lapland, to the North Pole, and we jump into a sauna. So we go from plus 100 centigrees to minus zero with our body. So for some reason, we're able, even though we have this very small margin of about 1 centigrade margin within the boundaries we should be, we're able to handle much larger circumstances, much dire circumstances than that. So some way our body is able to adapt to all this stuff. And then you put people on nail beds, you can sit on people here, you have this national contest of sitting on a pole for days in a time in a row. So our body is perfectly able to handle forces. And then suddenly we fall ill because someone put you in a bed. So I'm sort of like, hang on, that's too easy. So we have the categories, which doesn't mean anything about the etiology, doesn't tell you anything, nor what you should do to resolve it. And then the Americans started talking about injury. And the weird part is, of course, and in Dutch it's the same, there's all kinds of lawyers specializing in injury. Nobody is specialized in decubitus or in ulcers, but many are specialized in injury. So I was expecting it, but then indeed after a few months, it's like the old Star Trek one. It's life, but not as we know it. And this one was about injuries. Yes, it's a pressure injury, but not as we know it. So they had to bend over in all kinds of curves to escape the wrath of the juridical pieces of this of society. So then I in the end I said, well, why don't we go back to its origin and just call it decubitus? That was also in the article. Let's call it decubitus. And then start naming the kind of decubitus you have. It's like, and I always use, because wound care and oncology are closely related to each other. So I always ask, well, if you have cancer, we always say, yes, you have cancer. And then you explain what type of cancer you have, because that dictates your origin and what to do next. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about pressure injuries. Well, how many of those are actually trauma? How many are neuropathic, especially on the lower extremities, where you have all kinds of neuropathies? How many are system failures? The other thing that people tend to overlook is that before you have a wound, the system has already been challenged. And that means if your system is challenged, it has responded also. But it could be there's something wrong with the response. So figure that one out. But to my big surprise, nobody's interested. And pressure injuries remain just as that. And then we start talking about what we can do about it. And the latest fashion is talking about dressings, putting dressings on it, which is, of course, a lovely idea, but I question the relevance of it. Especially if you have, it makes sense if you have a pressure injury rate incidence of 10% or so in your institution. But that, if you have a 10% pressure injury rate in your institution, you either should have a very good reason or you have a very big problem in your care, in your general care. Because it shouldn't be that high. It should be somewhere around 1%, 2% maximum. And I was always wondering about the benchmarks. How low can you get if you have a proper institution? And then the other day I ran into a middle of the road Dutch hospital, 400 beds, nothing special, and they had a pressure ulcer incidence of 0.18%. So if you're, and that was including category one, so that's an amazing low rate and it doesn't come free. I mean, that's hard to do, but it shows it's possible. And if you do a lesser job, you might have 1% or 2%, but that should be it. And if I have a 10% pressure injury rate and I can use some dressings to reduce that, the first question is it the dressing or the fact that you have to apply the dressing every now and then, so you have to check your patients? That's the first remark, of course. And the second remark is that even if I have to apply, let's say, one dressing or I have to apply 50 dressings to have one patient less, that makes sense if you have an incidence of 10%. If you have an incidence of 1%, it's not going to be 50 patients for one dressing, it's going to be 500 patients or 500 dressings to resolve one patient, which means that the entire logic of applying the dressing falls apart. So those are the little fun things I run into when I start thinking about that. Hang on, what's going on? So that's my take on it.
Well, there were two points in that paper, and you touched a little bit on it, rather, that I found interesting. One was that you said that the MPIPs for injury stages were essentially dealing with the effects and not the cause. And
yes.
I found that very elucidating. And then I think in your third response, you said something hilarious, which not many people probably picked up on, but you made a reference to Ambroise Paré, 16th century French aristocrat and barber surgeon. And he said, at that time, he described the wound care standard of care that still exists to this day. And so, you know, if you could elucidate a little bit on those two points, I just thought those were the big takeaways for me out of that response.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other one is there's also what's his name? The works of Thomas Bainton. He describes a leg ulcer case where he uses compression and moist wound healing. And my question is always, okay, so what do we do today different? And then everybody says, in essence, we still do the same. So, okay, that means that since the day that was written and the day of today, we don't see very much progress. And then that was one from, that was a case from 1799. That's 200 years. So they also figured out, so, I mean, what we're doing in wound care, well, the good side is, because if we're doing it for 200 years, apparently it's effective. So that's, I mean, you have to be honest about that. But then in wound care in general, there's for some reason, we don't make much progress. And especially, and then we're back to pressure injuries. I mean, if Paré figured out already very early on what was the problem, and then we should have a finer grained idea of what's going on. What's going on in the tissue? There's, nobody has ever looked into the system of how tissue handles forces. If you're laying on a nail bed, but you don't get hurt, how does that work? because you should have millions of wounds on your back. How does that work? How does your body handle these forces? And it turns out that we have a system which is called the tensegrity system, which nobody ever looked up until the Harvard professor James Ingber figured it out, how that system worked. Because how do you properly transport forces into your tissue in a way that you don't surpass local thresholds? Because if you don't do that, I would expect if I sit on a nail bed to pop a lot of cells under that nail, and that would all be wounds. Well, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So why is that? So that and people totally overlook that. So that's and those questions I ask myself: how does this work? Why don't we have wounds? Why do we have wounds? And what's going on? And yeah, and then the other problem is it's the involvement of doctors. Wounds are a complication usually of something else, either from an operation or from a disease. And if you are a medical doctor, you are usually specialized in resolving a disease. And if you have a complication, you don't like that. So what to do with the complication? Well, who can handle this and doesn't bother me afterwards? Well, that's the nurse. So we place it at the nurses. And then we forgot that if you want to make progress, you have to do research. But nurse doing research, so today it is normal. But the last 200 years, as a nurse, you were not supposed to do research. You were just supposed to do as you were told. So that's the fundamental reason, which is, goes hundreds of years back, is why wound care is a bit the poor part of the unenlightened part of wound care. And today you see all these wonderful interventions we can do, wonderful things we can do. But I can't apply them in the Netherlands because I simply lack the medical doctors who have the knowledge to apply them. If you have a pressure injury, what doctor do you go to? What doctor specializes in pressure injuries? Well, we know them, but there's a few worldwide. So you don't have, I have a pressure injury. It's not uncommon to have one. So that's which doctor is taking care of me? Who starts talking about nutrition, moving, and whatever? We're not. What we're doing, we're putting them on the bed so they can lay nicely still, which essentially, if I put you in a chair and make sure you don't have to move, I just handed you a ticket to the valley of death, because then you're on a spiral downward to your death, because things only get worse from that point on. So that's the other thing about pressure injuries, is that if we don't think about the cause and we don't think about how to handle it, you start resolving the results of it or the symptoms of it, which essentially is not helping the patient. And the only thing it helps is the health insurer who's going to have an expensive customer list pretty soon. Yeah. So it's fun to think about it, but the consequences are not so funny generally. That's the other thing which gives me wound care.
Well, we always talk about, when we speak, the difference between the American system and the European system. And I think when I started wound care in 2011, it was definitely more nurse-centric. We have nurse practitioners as well. So the company that I was a partner at, we had nurse practitioners. But definitely what we've seen in the U.S. because of the payment system, and there's a lot of money in wound care, is now a lot of physicians are coming into the space. And there are mobile companies, mobile wound care is what we call it in the US, where there are a lot of physicians that are doing wound care, but a lot of advanced practitioners as well, whether they be a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. So I think it's interesting that you point out in Europe that there is this gap on the physician side.
I have to be honest with you. I mean, our nurses are very good. So that's not against, so the nurse remark is for the last 200 years. Mm-hmm. But now in today's society, it's not, the nurses today are just as good as the doctors we have. Because the question in the healthcare remains if someone fills that void. And if your payment system supports doctors, you will get doctors, and if it doesn't, you will get nurses. But everybody is dedicated to do so. But the only thing, my biggest problem is that, and that also applies to doctors, by the way, is nobody's properly thinking. They're not thinking it through. That's the biggest issue I have. recently meta-analysis on moist wound care in hospitals or anyway, meta-analysis on moist wound care dressings on patients. And there's no evidence. If you go to a cough drain, there's no evidence, and which is fine. But then nobody asks the question, why? Why is there no evidence? Because if I have a pig with six wounds on his back, I can easily show that moist heals 50% faster. Then I have seven prisoners, thank you, St. Quentin. I can prove it easily, that it's very effective. Yet, then we do a meta-analysis, we move to the general hospital or the general disease population, and this wonderful 50% faster healing, 40, 60, what is it? Fast healing evaporates. And nobody is wondering, what's going on? Why does this evaporate? And that's the question I asked over 25 years ago already. And nobody was willing to give me another answer. The only answer I got was, oh, is it this time already? I have to go now. Yeah, that was the main answer you got. Because this was this nasty biologist asking weird questions.
It's funny, you know, when I was had the wound care company, I'd ask them a question. Because I would go around and go to nursing homes. And then nursing homes would have these regulatory frameworks that they had to deal with. Yeah. And so, you know, I started asking questions like you, like, okay, we have two patients, same comorbidities, same everything that you can see, that you can observe, right? Why has one got this festering stage 4 pressure ulcer and the other does not? They're in the same unit, they're in the same room, you know?
Yes.
And so in my brain, I'm going, okay, there's a lot of heterogeneity going on here. There's a lot of other things going on. And then looking at staffing, right? So I then start looking at the numbers, go, okay, if staffing is up at one home or up in one unit versus another, does that have an effect? And a lot of the times it does, right? We know the science. Yeah. The science, as you point out, is fairly, not obvious, but it's fairly well known and has been well known. So if the science is being done, i.e. the standard of care, what is the failure? And the failure seems to be this mediation, right, of staff, time, attention.
That's the other part of this that's also fascinating, is you have to deal with reality. I had discussions here with people at nursing homes, and they said, why don't you put all your patients on wonderful mattresses and a nice prevention system, and et cetera, et cetera. So you can do that, then your incidence will drop dramatically. So yes, that sounds good. But how am I going to feed these patients? Because all the money I have went then into prevention of pressure injuries. So there's also the reality which kicks in. It's like, okay, you can't. There's things you can discuss over a cup of coffee. Then things are easy and simple. And in real life, it gets very complicated. So that's I agree with you, because it's staffing, it's financial problems, it's in the Netherlands, we're now looking at how are these wounds financed, because that is also a dramatic cause of patients floating around in the system, because it is on a whole is very expensive to have these patients, but the financial system is such that it is for the individual caregivers, it's cheaper to have them floating around.
There's actually a big debate. Medicare, the biggest payer here, is looking at the cost around wound care and this cost measures and things being put in, that they're trying to put into place. They started with non-pressure ulcers, and there was actually a testing phase about a month ago. And it's difficult, right? Because the incentives are to float patients out and to try to disperse that risk. In addition to that, you have the medical malpractice situation in the United States, which varies by state and by jurisdiction. But some jurisdictions, it can get very pernicious. In fact, pressure ulcers are the biggest risk for medical malpractice in the nursing home industry right now.
Then you see me laughing, because then I always wonder if you put unstageable pressure injury on your documentation. That is, in all of it, I would say, well, you forgot to debride the wound properly, you know? So,
unless you have a device on it.
I would think twice to put that on the paper in the US. Here, I would be gladly do that. But even for reasons I don't think make much sense. But even then, we gladly do that. But in the US, you're in trouble there.
It gets crazy. It gets absolutely crazy. Now, you mentioned something, and I want to, we have about 20 minutes left, but I just want to get to two things that I think are fascinating I'd love to talk about. In another paper in Wounds UK around 2018, you talk about adapting fast and slow horse-related tissue damage, which is kind of how you think about the damage to tissue in a pressure ulcer domain. Can you talk about what that is and walk us through horses, tissues, and adaptation?
Yes, what you see is that that's one of the, you can picture me as pressure injury guideline and look at the chapter etiology, and then you see this graph about high pressures in the beginning and then low and it goes up again. Damage. It's anyway interesting to look at your local pressure injury guideline to see, because there's chapter etiology, what's causing these things, and then try, and that's usually one or two pages, and try to find anything which is written in there further down in the guidelines, because you won't find it. So that's the futuristic part, first of all. But the thing we tend to overlook is that if you have tissue and you put forces in it, we tend to think, well, I did a lot of force. If I cut myself, the force executed on the tissue at the point of the edge of the knife exceeded what the tissue can handle. So that's the first step. And then we think, well, if you then if you put a patient on a rock or on a stone, you will compress stuff. And that's okay, because we're used to that, because then your body gets a signal and you start moving. But that if you don't move, and if you're 12 years old, if you don't move for a day, I think nothing will happen. But if you're 90 years old and you don't move for an hour, you're in trouble. So the first thing we start doing is start thinking about, okay, if I apply pressure on a tissue, it depends on the tissue itself, how it will play out. And then people start to think only linearly, like, okay, if I do it for 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours and then stop, that will increase the damage. But the other thing that can happen is if you only apply a mild force, but you do it repetitively, you also have damage, because the body needs time to recover. Because if you compress something, there's always going to be something going wrong. Because going back to the sauna story, if you're between 36.1 and 37.2 centigrades, I don't know what the Fahrenheit are, but that's 1 degree, a small window of 1 degree. So if you go outside of that, you don't immediately die, of course, but things go wrong. So that has to be restored. So if you apply pressure on tissue, it doesn't perhaps immediately pop and create a wound, but there's damage, of course, and it will take time to resolve. So that's why we said force is fast and slow. If you have a high force applied for a short period of time, you get a wound. If you have a high force applied for a relatively longer period of time, which means you lay in a bed and it's a hard surface, that's also not good. But then if you do that for a longer time and you have a patient who has a problem in recovering their tissue, because if you're 12 years old and I pinch your vessel, it will immediately pop back. If I do the same and you're 90 years old, it will take considerably longer. And then there's all kinds of reactions in the tissue. And that's also where the science comes short. There's something called reperfusion injury. Where if you pinch down a vessel on the front side of your pinch, the blood pressure will increase. But behind it, there will be no blood pressure, and the tissue will start thinking, hey, on, I have no exchange of gases and stuff. So let's open up the floodgates. So this capillary after you where you pinched it is wide open. And then you release the pressure, the blood flows through, and it shoots straight into your tissues, causing all kinds of damage. And it happens, but we don't know how relevant it is. And that's the other issue we have with forces, and also with forces fast and slow. We do not really know what the effect of these forces is, or that we understand what's going on. And that is where it's, and then, and the other thing is in tissue, because people tend to think one-dimensional linear, so we only think pressure, where it could be forces, it could be trauma. If you start pushing a patient to make a turn, you also you put tension on the tissue. And if there's a bone, you might also have a little rupture down there, which later on turns out to be a pressure injury. Or the other one is, that's a quickie, if you want to have pressure injury, that's a quickie, very effective, but you need an older patient. That is if you can see if the patient can go home. So you want to know if they can walk. So they're laying in bed, and then you want them to stand up, so they sound with them. So it all shoots up the back. Yeah, and then they have to turn because they put their legs on the ground, so you squeeze it. And then lo and behold, 3 days later, there's a big black spot happening there. And nobody knew who caused it. So that's a quickie if you want to have problems there as well. So there are all kinds of weird little causes of injury. So forces fast or slow is about that you have to think deeper about what's going on in the tissue. And if you have, I always say, if you haven't applied math, chemistry, physics, biology to your problem, you're quite certain that you've missed one or two things happening there. And they're not all relevant, but you might miss them. So that's the point about forces fast and slow.
Now that becomes very pertinent in a lot of the issues with pressure injury regulatory framework in the US. So a patient gets discharged from the hospital. The injury actually occurs at the hospital. They get transferred to the nursing home. They're at the nursing home for 3 days, and all of a sudden this new pressure ulcer, they call it nosocomial ulcerations here, comes to the fore. That mechanism you just described might be the case. It might have been injured in that setting, but the other setting is where we observe the pressure ulcer.
And the most worrying thing for me is that we're not able to put numbers on it. Because I can think of a myriad ways of people will get injured in their skin due to forces. But we don't know how many of those are reality. Because this reperfusion injury is there, but we don't have a clue of how many patients are suffering from it. Is it relevant? Do you have to take it into account? Are there other things you have to take into account? I mean, vitamin C, you need food. Because if you have a damaged body, it doesn't mean it shows. Before even stage one or category one pressure injuries, there's a whole lot of things going on in your tissue. So you might have collagen issues or inflammatory issues which don't show yet, but are there already. And if then your forces, repetitive forces is, or your pressure is repetitive, fast enough, so your collagen doesn't come back fast enough, then you're into trouble. We had in the Netherlands, we had a hospital where they had a whole bunch of pressure injuries on the board. And at some point, someone said, well, let's check their vitamin C levels. And it turned out there were, what is it, schurbuit, which you have if you have low vitamin C. It turns out these patients were this high above the absolute minimum vitamin C levels in the blood. So they popped everybody with some vitamin C and holding it up. I mean, the problem disappeared. Doesn't mean, and the fun part, it doesn't mean that's always the case. But we need to have proper ways of examining these people. And for properly examining these people, you need a body of evidence, and you also need a group of people who are interested in looking beyond we need a bed.
That makes sense. Interesting, this vitamin C case, that it's again, you as a biologist thinking about, or the person thinking from first order, right? Looking at the cause to effect rather than the effect, to kind of thinking, well, if I treat the effect, I'll deal with the cause. Which is kind of a backward way of thinking.
Exactly.
So I want to give you about 10 minutes, because I think one of the most interesting things you've written, and this originally came out in Wound UK in 2018, was an article called A 5-Level Model for Wound Analysis and Treatment. And I know you've been working on this repeatedly, iterating, changing certain things in it so that it becomes more digestible. But can you, you know, talk about what the five-level system is? Just what was the philosophy of it, or the philos? And then what are the five levels?
Yes, exactly. Well, the origin is somewhat complicated because it had to do with me mapping out my science. That was the origin of it. I won't bother you with that. What it turned out is that if you look at the numbers of patients you have, is that if you cut your finger, nothing happens. The wound will heal fine, but most people will cut their finger at one point. And then, so nothing happens. But then I started wondering, like, okay, what kind of problems do we have then? What kind of wounds do we have? So essentially, there are two types of wounds. There are wounds which occur, which happen because something happened to, or occurred, something happened to you. So you cut your finger, or you burnt yourself, or my peculiar fun part is you run into line 12 of the local bus company, which is a bit larger problem. So those are things that happen to you, or what else? Operational, post-operational wounds, stuff like that. So those are wounds, and nature is in such that these wounds should heal immediately. So normally, if you're 12 years old and you cut your finger, you have no problem. So I say that's a level zero wound. The zero stands for no problem at all. But if you get older, aging, there's something called homeostenosis. It's from geriatry. If you're nine years old and you fall on your knee, you don't have a problem. If you're 95 years old and you fall on your knee, there's a chance it kills you. So apparently, even though all being the same, there are things in your body which hinder the ability of the body to heal itself. And it turns out, I always say, it's your physical, mental, and socio-economical fitness, which has an impact on how well your body responds to the damage. So there's nothing else but you cutting your finger, that's all there is. And even then, we already have a whole group of things which will bother the body's response. It's age, it's even medication, there's medication which has an influence on it. Nutrition, how well are you fed, vitamin C, for instance. Smoking, drinking, drugs abuse, stress, and we can also, and I think not for all, but for most, I already can map out exactly the biochemical routes, how stress affects, what stress affects exactly in your, what your cells are doing in your wounds. So that's mappable. So that's the first step. And then of these people, if you're 95 years old, if you're 2 years old, you can have an extra problem. This is called, the problem is not because something happened to you, it's not because you're old, it's because you have a wound. The wound itself also has its drawbacks. And one of the drawbacks is, of course, infection. And the other one is there's fluid coming out of it. And if you have an infection, there's even more fluid coming out of it. And if you, people also fail to realize is that your most cells in your wound, they don't divide in the wound, they divide elsewhere, centimeter about the wound, and then migrate towards the wound. And especially your keratinocytes have to come from the outer skin, because if you have a deep wound, there's no other source of keratinocyte, and it's not like Scotty, beam me up into the wound, your body can't do that, so they have to come from somewhere. So they come from the outside of the wound. And if you then have macerated wound edges, because you didn't handle the fluid properly, these keratinocytes will run aground on your wound margins. So there's a whole bunch of problems which you can summarize with the TIME acronym. Was tissue, were tissues involved? Is there an infection, maceration? And what's the wound edge? So that's the TIME. That's level. So I call that level two. So we have level zero, you have a wound, nothing wrong. If you're old or all kinds of funny problems, you're on level one. Then because you have a wound, you get extra problems, which is called TIME. By the way, the level two is actually the realm of current wound care. You talk about dressing selection and infection, inflammatory, whatever you have. That's all on level two. And then there's another group of wounds you get, not because something happened to you. Well, that's how they usually occur. But that wounds because you have a problem. Your problem could be one of your vessels is locked, is closed. Or you have a venous problem, or you have a neuropathic problem, or you have a gout. Is always interesting. Real problems, the whole bunch of problems you have. You have skin disorders. All kinds of problems, but that is, you have an underlying problem. So that's another level. where you have to solve the problem. If you don't solve the problem, the wound will remain. And then there's a final part of it, and that is the weird one, and I'm not totally sure how to place wounds in that category. For instance, if you roll, your wound goes slow. What if your wound healing is wrong? So it's not per se the cause that is the problem. So you can have a leg ulcer due to an arterial problem, but then the reason that the wound stays open is not per se the vascular problem, but it's because your system is not responding properly. Where you can think about autoimmune issues, but also the complement reaction can go off the rails horribly, which will keep your wounds open. So there are all kinds of ways wounds can remain open. So now you have categorized your wounds in wounds because something happened to you and wounds because you have a problem. And the two exceptions is if your wound, which happens to you, is such dire or such a place that it becomes a problem, so then you cross over. And the other one is that you have something happening to you which makes you discover you have a problem because it doesn't close. So those are the four levels. And as it turns out, it's like a piece of chess on five boards at the same time. Because if you have a patient, most of the issues will be on level, you will need a wound first of all, level zero. And then the majority of people, 80% of the problems will be on level one. Most people will have those problems. And then to acquire an infection, usually you also have a problem in healing, otherwise it would have healed already. So where on the one hand, you can think each wound is in one level, but in reality, it's stacked. So you have a level one, zero wound, because you have a wound, level zero, that's the requirement for level zero. If you're older or weak or whatsoever, you have a zero plus one. Yeah, if you have problems in your wound, you have a zero plus one plus two wound. If this wound, usually because you don't get problems if you're healthy. So usually if you have a level three wound, which is due to an underlying problem, you also have level one issues, which means you're old or sick, and you have a wound, this is level zero. So they're all come up, and level four usually shows up after you have a combination of the problems before. So you have to evaluate the wound on all levels, and then you have to, and then you can call the wound, for instance, where your biggest problem is. And the other news is that we can also then attribute tasks based on the levels. Because if you only have a level zero wound, I would say mom will do it for you. That's okay. Put a kiss on it and it will heal. And if you have a level one wound, the problem is really the patient. So that could be a GP or someone who is about the welfare of the patient, quality of life of the patient. That's their job. And if you have a level two wound where you have problems in the wound itself, that's where the wound care nurse come in. If you have a level three wound, it means you have an underlying problem. We have to go to the relevant medical specialist usually to solve the problem, and then the wound will heal. And if you have a level four wound, you have a problem because we don't have those doctors usually. They're very rare, only a few of them worldwide. And the numbers are also 80-20 sort of, so most people have a normal wound, and then of those 20% will have a level one wound, and of those 20%, 20% will have a level two. And if I do that with the numbers in the Netherlands, it really plays out nicely. And you can also do wound healing time. You can do all kinds of funny math on it. So I had a look at some data from GPs, and it turns out that the level zero wound heals on average, because there are different sizes, but they're usually small, in 10 days. If you have a level one wound, it's 30 days. If you have a two wound, it's 60 days. If you have a level three wound, it's half a year. And if you have a level four wound, well, if you're lucky, it's a year. So sort of, and it's all ball game, but at least the fun part is it's not only category zero to three to four, it's also very different etiology. You have specific professionals for each category to solve that problem. And it turns out in practice, you can also give benchmark days. So if your wound is longer open for than 30 days, you might start wondering, do I have a level two, three, or four problem as well? So that's how it plays out. And it all came from a very simple schedule I made. And the longer I fiddle around with it, the more sense it starts making. So now finally, I teach my students to use a bathtub model for this, because you also have to communicate. Because I think most viewers by now will have be lost a bit when it comes to all the levels. So I said, well, imagine your patient is a bathtub, and that the damage is represented by water. And in the bathtub, there's a little dotted line there. And if the water rises, because if you have a closed vessel in your body, before the wound is there, there's already a lot of damage. So the water rises also up till this dotted line. If it crosses the line, then you have a wound. So you have a, and then the question is, first of all, how does the water get into it? Well, because something happened to you, that means a bucket of water is tossed in, or you have a problem, which means your tap is leaking. So those are the two things, how water gets in. Well, how does it get out? It gets out through the drain. That's the level four. And then what's causing problems in the bathtub? Well, because it's dirty, so the water won't flow out easily, so you have to keep it clean. And there you have sort of like all the levels that you have there, because if you now look at the bathtub, if you have a small bathtub or this formed bathtub, that means level one, water will rise faster, so you will sooner have a wound. So if you're 12 years and you lay in bed for a week, nothing happens, which I see with my kids. But if you lay in bed for an hour and you're 93, of all kinds, you run into trouble. So the shape of the bathtub, and I always say sort of like GP-like responsibilities there. And the other thing is, if you want to drain the bathtub, you better close the tap. Mm-hmm. So and then if you close the tap, the wound will heal. And that was medical specialists usually, unless you have pressure injuries, because there's nowhere to go to. And then the drain is, it has to be kept clean. That's the nurse's job. And if your drain is funnily organized, good luck. That would be my remark on that one. So that's how we use this bathtub, because it's easy to memorize, and that people usually get it. So that's the other thing. What I also see is, if I talk about with surgeons and dermatologists and plastic surgeons and what we have, everybody has their own view on wound care and their own way. What is it now? And nurses as well. So we have a myriad of communication problems where people have really issues in getting the message across or getting a proper view on what's going on with this patient, what do we need to do. And I hope that this little bathtub model gives some relief. It's not a solution. Nothing is a solution. You and I are here long enough to know that nothing will ever change, but we can just try. That's the good news. So that's the idea about the five levels.
I think I think we've talked about this before, and you know what you described in terms of the 80-20. I mean, we talked about the Pareto distribution and kind of how it's recursive, right? So if you take that 20%, 80% of that is, once you solve the issue, underlying issue will resolve, and then you'll have a 20% left there. And then you recurse into that. And so I think you're right. In aggregate, are we going to solve all wounds in our industry? No, but if we can focus our attention on those 20% that really incur costs, I think that's really important. As you can hear, our time is going off. And so it's yelling at me. But I have one last question for you. And this is a question that I'm going to ask all the guests. If you had a genie, right? We'll call him the wound genie. And it could grant you any wish in wound care, right? What would you wish for? To happen in wound care at kind of a macro level?
I would wish that we would train wound care as a proper medical field. I think wound medicine is, you could call it the science of how your body maintains or restores homeostasis. We don't have that. So what I'm missing is a really underlying foundational view on wound care. That would be my wish, because that would solve many, many issues in the future. I have a second one, but it's for the Netherlands. We have 100,000 patients we shouldn't have. So I wish I could get rid of them, because I don't think we should. Any patient suffering unnecessarily is one too much, but that's for the net bad situation.
No, I appreciate that. And this has been a great conversation. As always, I love the way you think. I love the way that you kind of look at these things at a very micro level and very scientifically. And, you know, as a fellow belligerent person, I love the fact that you wade into these rivers throwing elbows. So
yeah.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate your time. And thank you for sharing with us today.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was real fun. Talk to you soon.
All right, then. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.